One of the underground art galleries that I discovered down in the storm drains. Basically, you walk in about a half mile in pitch dark, and you have artwork going down the walls that goes down for about a half mile.
Ahead, the tunnel devours our flashlight beams. I keep hearing noises that make me stop and shine the light back in the other direction.
There's always the butterflies. There's always that apprehension when you walk into a storm drain. Just because even if you've been in the drain the day before, that doesn't mean it's going to be the same environment, you know, coming down the next day. I've even met people down in the drains who are really cool one day, and then you come back the next day and it's not cool, you know, all of a sudden. They'll tell you to screw off or kind of reach for their shank or their self-defense weapon and make it clear they don't want to talk to you today, so.
Over the years, O'Brien has met more than 100 people who live in the tunnels. They're scattered in pockets across the city. We head away from the trickling water, down a side channel that stays dry most of the time. The ceiling gets lower, the corridor narrower, and the air becomes stale with the faint scent of body odor and human waste. We arrive at an encampment, a kind of cardboard lean-to.
Yo, anyone here?
Continuing on, we come upon two men sitting in the glow of candlelight. One of them, with a shag of greasy hair, is slumped on a couch. In front of him, on a makeshift coffee table, are a few hypodermic needles. The other man is better groomed. He's wearing a button-down shirt and a decent pair of slacks. To my relief, they both know Matt O'Brien.
Hey, man, check this out.
Thanks for the Thanksgiving thing.
Brian and Steve haven't seen Matt since he was down here last Thanksgiving.
We came back and there was Thanksgiving dinner on each of our beds. Big turkey and stuffing, and it was pretty good.
Steve is the well-dressed one. He's 42, grew up in Las Vegas, and he makes his living at casinos around town, doing what's known as silver mining, which means he looks for credits left behind on slot machines.
And I'll start at Harrah's, and depending on how I feel, I'll go to either the Venetian or the Mirage. A lot depends on how I look, because those are two very hard places. If you don't look right, they'll stop you and or watch you. It's always busy at Harrah's, so you're able to walk through the casino without, you know, drawing much attention to yourself.
To blend in, you need to dress the part. Steve has a rack of button-down shirts and slacks. He takes us to his quarters, cardboard walls enclosing a queen-size bed, a dresser, even a makeshift shower.
2.5-gallon water jugs. Try to keep these two full right here, and just, you know, pull the knobs out. I got all the supplies and stuff. Shaving cream, shampoo.
You got a little mirror right there?
Yep, got my mirror there. My little stand here. Water overflow bucket. Like I said, try to live comfortable if I got to be out here.
Steve says his luck varies. The night before, he'd visited several casinos, and things hadn't been going so well.
Then I went to the Bellagio, I was walking through, going, darn, this is just going to be a hopeless case. I turned the corner in one area of the casino, and there on the machine was $116. Nobody around, so I hit the cash out button, took it, cashed it out, and that was the end of my night. You know, it helped me out today. I ate very well today. I had a late breakfast last night, and I still got about $50 left.
But Steve is addicted to methamphetamine and gambling, so holding on to money can be difficult.
That's what I'm trying not to do, is gamble my money away anymore. And as far as the drugs, I'm trying to slowly get myself, you know, to where I don't crave it. Tonight I'm taking it easy. I figure I'll just call it an early night and see what I can do tomorrow.
After a while in the Las Vegas storm drains, it's easy to forget that directly overhead is a very different world. Matt O'Brien is often struck by the contrast.
You can be in the Hard Rock Casino, which is one of the hipper, kind of younger, richer hotel casinos in town, kind of celebrity watching, people watching, betting $1,000 per hand in a game of blackjack. And right underneath the Hard Rock is one of the worst skid rows I've ever seen in my life.
Broken bottles, hypodermic needles strewn all over the tunnel floor, people passed out.
And last time I was down in there, I actually saw some blankets and like teddy bears and stuffed animals and stuff, which gave me the impression that a young kid was living down in there with a mom or dad or both.
That contrast is what kept O'Brien coming back to the tunnels long after the book was finished. He brings food and clothing to people like Brian and Steve on a regular basis. And the tunnels have become a kind of refuge for him, too, from the city.
when work wasn't going all that great or my relationship with my girlfriend wasn't that great, that I would just strap on the boots and grab the flashlight and just walk a tunnel to get away from everything above ground. You know, in some ways, there are certain things about underground Vegas that I prefer to above ground Vegas.
Once, we walked a long tunnel that led to the dark recesses of a parking structure. A little further, and we were back in a crush of pedestrians on the Las Vegas Strip. Matt O'Brien looked a little out of place, with his dark clothing, knit cap, muddy boots, still clutching a heavy-duty flashlight. Then, an idea popped in my head. Maybe O'Brien should become the official guide to the storm drains. Visitors could explore the underbelly of Las Vegas. They would meet real, live human casualties of a city that trades on excess. Then again, that might be too real. Besides, surveying all the tourists, no one was checking out the gutters. Everyone was looking up at the flickering lights.
Sucked into the Tunnels Beneath Las Vegas was produced by Adam Burke. The piece aired on NPR's Day to Day and won the Third Coast Best News Feature Award, which is no small feat. Each year, hundreds of entries pour into the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation competition from all over the world. Then, no less than 27 esteemed judges tackle the impossible job of sifting and sorting, discussing and deciding on the winners. Those documentaries that tell the most compelling stories and use sound in the most interesting and surprising ways. The judges reserve one award for a producer who's new to the business and shows a flair for creativity and innovation. This year, the Best New Artist Award went to a story that takes listeners into an art gallery, but not to look at the art on the walls. When I talked with producer Sophia Saldana, she said she went to Tate Britain in London and talked to the museum guards.
I'm always very interested in the work people do. I always want to try to do that for a while in a supermarket. Or I always feel curious about how is it like to work here?
Sophia found that the guards' inner lives are just as complex as the art they protect. Here's an excerpt from her award-winning story, The Sleeping Fool.
First thing in the morning, when there's hardly anyone here, I found it really peaceful and restful, and it's nice having the paintings around you.
It's a very easy job, so you just have to turn up and literally just walk around. I've got lots of friends here, some close kind of relationships with people. It doesn't always feel like a job. There are problems sometimes with things like evacuations or suspect bags, but for the most part, it's a relatively easy job.
An art gallery is an art environment, so you don't have to be strict, you know, it's an open thing. You interact with the people, you speak with the people. It's not like years ago that the role of a gallery assistant was to stay in one room and you couldn't speak, you couldn't, you know, even talk to the visitors.
You often get normally American people that will come up and just bark questions at you without perhaps an introduction of hello or how are you. But you also get a certain class of English person that might come up and say, where are the toilets? Or something like that. They would bark something at you. And I always try to say, well, first of all, good morning, or try to kind of bring them back into a civilized form of behavior. But those are the rude ones. But they are a minority.
When you're working as a gallery assistant, you put on the uniform and you become invisible. People don't tend not to see you. They tend to give you less respect. They tend to speak down to you because they think you are less educated because you're doing a job that's not highly skilled. But at the same time, it's just that you feel less valued as a person because you're working in a job that's... I know lots of people have been doing it for a long time, but for me, I think that it's... You get treated not like you should be treated as a person.
I suppose if you're having problems in your personal life or if you're worried about something, you've got lots of time to think and dwell on things. So if something was bothering you, you can just imagine the worst.
Yeah, everything is a lot bigger than it seems because you've got nothing better to do and you're not allowed to talk. So you end up thinking about, if you have a small problem, it gets blown up into a massive problem because your mind keeps on playing on it over and over again. If you're tired, you just get more grumpy. If you're happy, if you're happy, the day tends to go by a bit quicker. Your concept of time, I think, changes when your mind is in a different place.
Oh, well, that's totally the opposite for me. When you are surrounded by artwork that you like, that is more likely for me to ease the problem, you know, in a way, but it certainly doesn't amplify it.
It's fun. It's good fun to be there, and it's good that we're surrounded by the works of art, and it can inspire us, particularly my work, if I want to, you know, give me some inspiration. But at the end of the day, it's a job. It's a, you know, 8 hours job, and who likes to do it? I don't.
The Sleeping Fool by Portuguese producer Sofia Saldanha for Goldsmiths College in the UK. Sofia won the Third Coast's 2010 Best New Artist Award. To listen to this story in its entirety or any of the other 2010 award winners, go to thirdcoastfestival.org. I'm Gwen Macsai, and you're listening to Best of the Best, the 2010 Third Coast Festival broadcast. The Third Coast International Audio Festival is an independent, nonprofit arts organization made possible with lead support from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Questions or comments? Write to info@thirdcoastfestival.org. Coming up after the break, the Third Coast Silver Award winner. Best of the Best is produced by the Third Coast Festival and distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.
As you make your year-end giving decisions, please consider a gift to WILL. Listener support is the heart and soul of this station, and your gift will help pay for the programs you rely on next year. You can make a contribution online now at willpledge.org or mail a check to Friends of WILL, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. Thank you.
Welcome back to Best of the Best, the 2010 Third Coast Festival broadcast. I'm Gwen Macsai. In this hospital room, a mother just delivered a child. But the child will only live 10 minutes. A photographer helps capture the beauty and agony of this excruciatingly intimate moment. Producer Mary Beth Kirshner brings us Capturing the Brief Life and Death of an Infant, winner of a Best Documentary Honorable Mention Award.
Joanna Bloom had known for months that she wanted a photographer to be there at the birth of her baby son. Doctors did not expect him to live. On December 1st, Joanna had an emergency C-section. Her husband was sitting at her side, holding her hand. There was a blur of activity in the operating room.
And I looked towards the wall, and I saw this really unassuming figure dressed up in a gown, her face covered, and she was holding the camera in her hand.
Doctors whisked Joanna's 2-pound, 11-ounce baby away, and they struggled to keep Baruch Levi Bloom alive for 10 long minutes. He had a birth defect of the brain, and his heart had failed. His tiny body was brought to Joanna in the recovery room. Ashley Hutchison was there, too.
When I walked into the room where Joanna was with her son, she looked up at me, and we locked eyes and kind of looked at each other, and there was a small smile from both of us, and said to her, "Wow, he looks beautiful. He's pretty beautiful."
Oh.
When I start taking pictures, it's like I'm not there. So Joanna looked down at her son, and that was that. They were having their moment, and I was in the background, and it's that simple.
Oh. Ashley Hutchison is a photojournalist in Toronto. Joanna found Ashley through the nonprofit organization Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep, which connects volunteer photographers with parents who want their babies memorialized. During the past year, Ashley has photographed 15 stillborn infants and their families.
I do have a sense and an understanding of how important these pictures will be to the family. But that's something I do try to keep out of my mind when I'm there, because it is a very stressful thought. If it doesn't work out, or if the lighting's not right, or all of these things that you might think about as a photographer are not important. And I guess what it comes down to is that even if one picture works out, that's all they need.
That's great. I'm going to move this so I can see his beautiful little face. Oh, looks great.
So nice.
Joanna Bloom was born in Poland. She has five children at home, ranging in age from 16 years to 15 months. Joanna says baby Baruch has the same curly hair and nose of her other kids. Ashley captured Joanna gazing at every detail.
Just so perfect. Mm-hmm. Just so perfect.
Joanna's favorite photo was taken minutes later.
When I undressed the baby and I just put him on my bare chest, but I could still feel the warmth of his body and the softness of his skin, welcome him and I suppose say goodbye to him at the same time. Oh my God. I was absolutely stunned by the beauty of his whole being. I don't even know if there's any words to describe. No matter what your background or, you know, what your beliefs or your religion, there was something so divine and so much bigger than all of us. It's so hard to believe. It almost felt as though we were not holding a baby, but as though we were holding an angel.
That was an excerpt from Capturing the Brief Life and Death of an Infant, winner of a 2010 Third Coast Honorable Mention Award, produced by Mary Beth Kirshner. It aired on NPR's All Things Considered as part of the Obituary Project, Lives of the Unnoticed. Capturing powerful moments on tape is the seasoned audio producer's specialty, but even the best producers can't plan or predict what they're going to get. Bridget McGee had a very powerful story to tell. In 1951, Bridget's grandfather, a black man, was executed for the rape of a white woman. Working for months with producers Joe Richman and Samara Freemark, they uncovered layer after layer of the untold story, rustling more than a few feathers along the way. Their investigation led them to Mississippi, where they discovered a live radio broadcast from the scene of the execution, along with numerous lies, and behind those, at least as many secrets. Here's an excerpt from this year's Best Documentary Silver Award winner, Willie McGee and the Traveling Electric Chair, told by Willie's granddaughter, Bridget.
The Mississippi Correctional Officers Academy.
Hi. Yes, we wanted to come in and see the Traveling Electric Chair.
Yes, ma'am, but it's been here a long time. We've had it.
Long time.
But it's over in that front lot.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Mississippi used to have what they called a traveling electric chair. They would take it from town to town. They would set it up in the courthouse, electrocute the person, pack it up, and take it to the next spot. Then we come around the corner, and there is this electric chair, not on display, just sitting in a corner with some baseball trophies. It was not what I expected at all.
Are you sure this is the right one?
I thought the electric chair would look like, I don't know, something made of metal with a head thing that comes off on your head or something. Or
It's just a wooden rocking chair is what it looks like. Chair that somebody would sit on their porch and watch the cars go by. Who in their right mind created this thing? I don't know, this is just, I don't want to record anymore.
I'm sure that you have heard over both radio stations, WFOR and WAML, that all channels open to Willie McGee to save his life have now been exhausted, and the execution is to take place here this evening.
I went up that night to watch the execution, and the crowd was already gathering. There were hundreds of people all over the place.
The weather was good. It was a nice night because it wasn't too hot and it wasn't too cold. People were visiting with each other and, you know, talking, passing time away.
I think the majority of the crowd is now over here on this side of the courthouse where they can see and hear the power unit for the state of Mississippi's portable electric chair.
The execution was broadcast on the radio. And I'll never forget to this day, as the announcer mentioned some young boy who had climbed up a tree.
We note that there's a boy over here in a tree climbing ever higher into the branches.
And was looking inside the window
where
Mr. McGee was going to be executed.
It's now straight up of 12 o'clock, and certainly there can be no more than 2 minutes left to go. And I think perhaps the best thing we could do is just hang this mic over and pick up the grind of that generator so that we'll be sure and pick it up. Jim, if you're listening, you might jack our gain up a little bit. Ladies and gentlemen, we just assume that that last surge was the final few thousand volts of electricity that meant the end of Willie McGee. Okay, Granville, thank you very much. Certainly WAML and WFOR intended no sensationalism in this. It was simply that it was a news story, and we wanted to cover it as best we possibly could. So thank you all very much for listening. This is Jack Dix then returning you to your respective local studios.
Willie McGee's body was taken to Pete Christian's funeral home, and my mother and father took me over there. And I knew what I was going there for, you know. It was like a business that had to be taken care of. And you go in there and you view the body. And I did not close my eyes. I did not close my eyes because that was a specific message that my daddy wanted me to get. And that message was, you do not get connected with white girls. You see what happened to Willie McGee. And I understood that. And, you know, my daddy let me see it long enough to get the message and then took me back home.
After his execution, everybody pretty well washed their hands. That was the end of it. They said, we've suffered. The city has suffered. We're glad it's over. Let's forget it.
The blacks and whites didn't talk about it between them. Even today. None of the blacks I've had that helped me through the years, we never mentioned it. They believed he was innocent, and the whites believed he was guilty. Simple as that. It's always going to be that way. And it was just not a good thing to argue about it.
There's one more person I really need to speak with. I am going now to meet John Schwarzfeger. His dad prosecuted my grandfather back in 1951.
He was the one who basically sent my grandfather to the electric chair.
So we came up to his house, and I was very nervous. And he opened up the door, and him and his wife.
Yeah, so nice to meet you.
And they looked at me, and he hugged me.
Y'all just go ahead and make yourselves comfortable.
Well, I remember the night of the execution very well. We were all standing in the kitchen, and my father reached up in the cabinet and got a pint of bourbon, and he took the fifth of whiskey, hid it inside his coat, and when he got to the courthouse, he told the sheriff that he wanted to see Willie McGee alone in a room, just the two of them, and they sat and they talked while Mr. McGee drank the whiskey, And my father asked him, said, did you or did you not rape Mrs. Hawkins? Were you guilty? And he got his answer. And my father never divulged it to anyone else, and I'm not going to divulge it now.
I wouldn't want you to go against your father's wishes, but I still want to know as much history as I can about my grandfather. I'm not looking for him to be wrong, nor I'm trying to find out if he was right, but it sure would make me feel better to know.
I certainly appreciate what you're saying, but we have to take into consideration there was a pint of bourbon involved. I mean, this man was facing death in a matter of an hour or so. And what a person would say at that time, especially if they had been drinking, I just don't think it's fair to repeat them.
But I also know that a drunk speaks a sober mind. And at that point in time, what did he have to lose anyway?
I wish I wouldn't have told you. Now, I mean, I really do, because as much as I know that everybody wants me to say he said yes, he did it, or no, he didn't do it, is I can't say that. I'm not going to say that. To keep rehashing something that happened 60 years ago can't possibly bring about any good now.
But me as a granddaughter, I'm here to get information because there's another generation ahead of me that carries the McGee name now. And they don't even know any of the history of what happened. So that's my place.
Bridget, I certainly have a great deal of compassion for your family. I mean, none of y'all did anything. I'll give you your answer because I think you're entitled to it. But I'm going to do it for you, off the record, alone. Is that fair enough?
That's fair.
All right.
How you doing?
I'm good. I'm
sorry.
I'm Bobby Bender.
Hi, Bobby.
All right.
We're trying to locate where my grandfather could be buried, where his body could be laid.
If they were buried during that time frame, they would be in this location right out here somewhere. You know, but there are a lot of grave sites out there. The markers have been knocked off, and all there is just like a little indentation in the ground to show that there's a body that's buried there.
You mind if I just take a look at the church? So you're saying anything that's unmarked could be Willie McGee's gravesite?
Yes.
For all I know, I could be standing on top of his grave. Who knows?
Things are never as clear-cut as we want them to be. The words that my grandfather said that night before his execution, I've been keeping those words a secret. But recently, John Schwarzfeger has given me permission to share them. The prosecutor asked my grandfather as they were drinking, "Did you have sex with Willette Hawkins?" And my grandfather looked up at him and said, "Yes, sir. But she wanted it just as much as I did." How do I feel about those words? I don't know. I'm not really sure. I don't think we will ever know the total truth. But I know what I believe, and that's my truth. And so when my kids and my grandkids, my nephews and my great-nephews come to me and ask me who was my great-grandfather, I'll be able to tell them. This is the story of Willie McGee.
That was an excerpt of Willie McGee and the Traveling Electric Chair, produced by Joe Richman and Samara Freemark of Radio Diaries, reported and narrated by Bridget McGee. The piece aired on NPR's All Things Considered and the BBC World Service, which means that Bridget's story has been heard in Nigeria, Ghana, and Pakistan, among other countries.
This was a family story that hung over Bridget for years. Here she is at the Third Coast Awards Ceremony in Chicago.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my granddad's story. Oh, gosh. On my mother's deathbed, I made a promise to her that I would pursue it. And for a lot of years, I thought I let her down. But this particular year, I made my mind up to go ahead and pursue it and go to Mississippi. I didn't think my story would go this far to see an award. And my auntie, who is the only living relative left to my granddad, and I just want to dedicate that award to my granddaddy and to my mother and to my auntie, and I do appreciate you guys, and thank you very much.
For a link to photographs of Willie McGee as a young man, and to hear this story in its entirety, go to thirdcoastfestival.org. I'm Gwen Maxey, and you're listening to Best of the Best, the 2010 Third Coast Festival broadcast. The Third Coast International Audio Festival is an independent, nonprofit arts organization. We'd love to hear your thoughts about today's show. Write to us at info@thirdcoastfestival.org. Coming up after the break, the Third Coast Gold Award winner. Best of the Best is produced by the Third Coast Festival and distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.
This Christmas season brings a new collection of holiday stories from the NPR archives. John Henry Falk, David Sedaris, Scott Simon, these and other NPR voices, past and present, telling stories of the season in a new Christmas program. I'm Lynn Neary. Join me for Tinsel Tales from NPR.
Friday morning at 11 on AM 580.
Welcome back to Best of the Best, the 2010 Third Coast Festival broadcast. I'm Gwen Maxey, and now we come to our Best Documentary Gold Award winner. The top prize in this year's Third Coast Richard H. Driehaus Foundation competition goes to an honest and simple story that unfolds slowly, giving us a life in reflection. The subject of the story is Bernard, 86 years old and living alone in South London. His experience of love and loss has something to offer us all. Here's an excerpt from An Interior Life by Lawrence Grizel.
Yes, sir. Now, I make my porridge every morning. It's always the same old thing. Two parts liquid to one part oats and some sweetener. 4 minutes, 1, 2, 3, 4, at 30, and that can cook on its own now. Ron used to have a little cereal in the morning, and then after he'd had that, he'd have one piece of wholemeal toast with my chunky marmalade on it. He was very partial to the marmalade I used to make. I normally eat watching television. Oh, here we go. I'll just... Yes. There's my porridge. The Jeremy Kyle Show.
Before the break, I was talking to Mark. Big day for you. You've been very honest. You were with Laura Jane for 7.5 months.
You revealed you were pregnant and admitted you cheated. Am I the dad? Yes.
Bombshell, Boxing Day.
And now they're going to have a blood test or something, and the audience will shriek with laughter or clap madly.
30 weeks, 4 blokes, not a great idea. Get real.
People my own age are shocked by it.
Absolutely, yeah?
I've got an antidepressant, a steroid for the gout in my upper body, pills here that I take for the gout in my foot, omeprazole, which is for the reflux and blood thinner or something. Oh, it's not a nice thing to get old of and destroy.
What will Laura Jane think of Mark's allegations? And we will give them and you those all-important DNA results. Don't go anywhere, because I'm right back.
We'll come out of the warm, and I'll take you around my frozen house. Now, this was Ron's computer room, and it had lots of equipment in here, which I've been giving away. Oh, God. Look at that. To come across this after, I suppose, about 60 years or more, it's quite incredible. I've got here a little book that I started using when I was 16 to jot down any pieces of music I heard on the radio, and then I would sort of express how I felt about it. And what's this I've got? I wish I could read my own writing. Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto No. 1. I so loved Tchaikovsky when I was younger. And then I heard that he was a homosexual in some program, and I wouldn't listen to any of his works for about 10 years or more. That shows you how much I was against being the way I was. Who is this? Mahler. Symphony No. 9 in D. Music richly suited to solitary appreciation of oceans of thought, beauty in pain. Yes, I love my music. I was born in 1922. And I've been living in this house for the last 70 years. My mother was Madame Co. She came from France when her mother died. And my father was Thomas Bond. He came from Lancashire. He was chief cashier. It was a fairly big bank, but that all went for a Burton. In 1929, he took to gambling and drinking to excess, and a hell of a lot of money went that way too. There was constant arguments, fueled by alcohol, a very lonely childhood. I became frightened of the house. I just got out of the house as quickly as I could and played in the garden. Till I was 13, I was living a fairly wild boy of the woods life, I think. Sibelius was my first love. I used to sort of have these fantasy scenes I would create. And in this fantasy, I wasn't trying to be a heterosexual. I would have wonderful encounters. Thank you. And now we're going up the stairs, and I'm not using my stair lift. And here are all the photographs that Ron took on our various holidays. They're fading now, but I know what's on them, and it's nice to look at them. My bedroom, made for a sick person, this is. As you see, I don't make my bed until, well, I'd normally come up and do it about now. Just put these up. And you'll notice I've got my, on the top of my bed, not to be resuscitated. And beside there is my living will thing that says, in the event of my death, keep my body in good condition and send it away to the London, whatever it is. So nobody's going to have to bother about a funeral for me. That's that, and now I can show you Ron's bedroom. Oh, dear me. I haven't said good morning to Ron's bears. I was just... This is very eccentric, I know, but I've got a bed full of bears that was one of the most important things in Ron's life. And this makes him sound as weird as I am, but he was the very, very dour sort of lad. He didn't tolerate fools easily. That's Benji, and that's Bampi. This one came from East Wittering. He had a big bow on him, so we called him Bowie. This one is, because he's in the style of a Steiff bear, was called Steiff. Who are you? Oh, don't look at me like that. Sidley, Sid. He was bought in Sidmouth. There's Biddy. There's a long history to every one of them. Ron got a very bad attack of flu, and I went to do some shopping. And I thought, I think I'll take him a teddy bear. And it started up an obsession, really. This one, Ron, won this one in a lottery, so we called him Sweetie Pie. There's Bedward. You know, you'd never believe it, but he was so fond of these bears. We had almost a day's discussion as to what was to happen to them when it looked as though we were going to reach the end of the road. He said, I think we'll think that they will live until the last one of us pass away and then they'll go with us. I said, right, we'll do that. So that's the story of the bears.
Producer Lawrence Grizel had over 20 hours of raw tape to work with. Inevitably, favorite bits had to be cut. For instance, Lawrence said Bernard is an amateur inventor, and you can see his handiwork around his house.
One of the things he has is a cutlery holder, which he's made out of a shampoo bottle, which he's fixed to the side of the table by the side of his chair in the living room. So he's always got some standby cutlery in this converted shampoo holder. You know, domestic life can be banal, but it can also be quite moving in a way. I mean, he had a way of expressing himself and an insight into his condition that I thought was quite unusual, quite rare. Bernard can talk. After the first day of interviewing, I think we'd only got as far as him being about 5 or 6 years old. You know, I thought, at this rate, I mean, the guy's 86. You know, at this rate, you know, it's going to take an awfully long time.
The luxury of this piece is that it's able to unfold slowly. Over the course of 37 minutes, Bernard reflects on his past and two long-term relationships as he goes about his day. Then, toward the end of the story, things take an unexpected but happy turn for Bernard.
Good morning, sir. Good
morning.
How are we?
Oh, I'm all right. How are you?
Good. Can I get a hot drink, Matt?
Yes, that would be nice. Thank you very
Chocolate
much.
Chocolate?
It's cold, isn't it? Blimey. So cold out there.
I shall get it ready.
Thank you very much.
Okay, boy. Beginning of last year, suddenly this chap phoned me up from a group in Croydon, the Silver Rainbow for Older Gay Men, where you go and have a luncheon and meet people like interests, and they didn't look very old to me when I went there first. Everybody seemed so young compared with myself. And there was a chap sitting next to me, David. That was the start of our friendship.
You know, it's almost like a spring day after that cold weather. The temperature's lifted. I suppose it's about 4 centigrade, but it feels like summer, doesn't it, after the temperatures we've had?
Do you think you'd like a walk later, or you?
Oh, I think so, definitely. If it stays like this. That's a nice shrub there, that viburnum, isn't it? The winter... I always get that mixed up with winter sweet.
Well, I think that's another word for it.
It's another word for it, is it?
Very sweet smelling. Mm,
a couple of pieces of that brought indoors, put in a bit of damp sand.
We decided to meet up and have a cup of tea. I went down to his home. And, yes, I think he's a remarkable chap.
The moment he walked in the house and we started talking, I knew I could trust him. It was as though we'd known one another for years. It was phenomenal. And he's got such a caring way about him.
Life was very similar for both of us. He's helped me quite a lot about talking about aspects of my life. We've compared notes, and he's been very kind to me. He's very good at making cakes.
I think meeting someone has set my brain going, and I've got the placebo effect of what a relationship can do. You can rise above your illnesses and whatnot, and function almost normally. And I even one day realised I hadn't taken any painkillers.
Sometimes I go and see him, and I'm down there for about 4 or 5 hours talking. Yes, it's working extremely well.
I'm going to have a look at the weather forecast.
The BBC said on Sunday it would be 8 centigrade. Oh, you've got the old CFAX. The new one on the digital telly is entirely different to this.
I'm sure it is. I mean, I'm running on steam here.
No, this is a better one because you've got more control over it.
When I met David, I uncovered all the stuff that was put into Ron's chair, and David sat in Ron's chair, and that broke another sort of taboo.
Oh, here we are.
What does that say there? Because if it's like this, it would be wonderful.
It's mild all over the country.
Yes.
Looks as though in the north it's going to be starting to turn colder again.
Before I met David, I would think of, what shall I prepare for my meal tonight? What's in the Radio Times for me to watch or listen to? And that would be my day. Since meeting David, I am a changed person. I am looking to a future. This is a list of all my LPs. And it's stating whether they're stereo or mono, because there's some real old geezers among this lot, I can tell you. Symphony number 2. Yes. I don't even know how to use it after all this time. I'd give you... Listen to my records for about 25 years, I should think. But I got such a buzz looking at them again. I've decided I'm going to start listening to them and blow television when it's rubbish.
Right.
He looked at the temperature and suddenly realised it was warm enough to go out there.
I'm looking forward to doing things, for a time anyway, to go and meet people, and I can't believe it that I'm able to walk properly now. Now I've got to get my hat.
It's a lovely day, isn't it? Beautiful.
I even hope to get back in the garden. It's like a rebirth, really. See? This is Norwood Lake. This is. Oh, look, it's still frozen. Yes, which way around shall we go? You want to go this way, do you?
We're on the southern side, aren't we?
Fantastic day. And the birds are very... Hello there, how are you? All right? Isn't it? It's a new life. Come on, David. We've finished.
What a difference a bit of sunshine makes, eh?
What a difference a day makes. That's another song.
An Interior Life, winner of the 2010 Third Coast Gold Award, produced by Lawrence Grizel for BBC Radio 4 with mixing engineer Richard Hannaford and editor Rob Kettridge. Lawrence had the last word at the Third Coast Awards ceremony in front of fellow producers and radio fans.
If I can for a moment sort of be motivational, be bold, take risks, and keep finding those untold stories and lending them an ear. Thank you very much.
For 10 years, the Third Coast Festival has celebrated the truth in all stories, wherever they come from, however they're told, whether they're grand and sweeping, compressed and tidy. In the best of them, somewhere we see and hear ourselves. We hope you've enjoyed listening to our 10th anniversary gift to you, the 2010 Third Coast Award winners. Feel free to re-gift and spread the word. All this great work can be found in its entirety at thirdcoastfestival.org. Thanks for joining us for Best of the Best, the 2010 Third Coast Festival broadcast. I'm Gwen Maxey. The executive director of the festival is Johanna Zorn. The artistic director is Julie Shapiro. Katie Mingle produces the Third Coast Festival's weekly radio show, ReSound. The Third Coast International Audio Festival is a nonprofit arts organization made possible with lead support from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Additional support is provided by the Boeing Company Charitable Trust, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, Chicago's Navy Pier, and American Airlines. The Third Coast International Audio Festival was founded in 2000 by WBEZ Chicago. Best of the Best is produced by Emily Botine, with support from Katie Mingle and Ben Shapiro for the Third Coast International Audio Festival, and is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.
Tim Nugent's vision made a college education possible for people with disabilities at the University of Illinois.
Well, the campus still enjoys its standing as a pioneering leader in accommodating persons with disabilities because of Nugent.
Tune into the story, Breaking Down Disability Barriers, The Legacy of Tim Nugent, December 24th at 2:06 p.m. on WILL AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD3 Urbana.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by the Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, located in Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. I'm Tom Rogers, and the Afternoon Magazine comes your way after NPR News at 12:01. Looking quickly at the markets right now, the soybean prices have hit a 27-month high as we head into the holiday season. The corn trade is mixed and the wheat lower in very light trade. Kansas City hard red winter wheat is currently trading down 3.5 cents at $8.41 a bushel. The Chicago March wheat contract at $7.79, down 4.5, May also down 4.5, 8.05 and a quarter. March corn is down a quarter penny at 6.08 and three quarters. May is at 6.17 unchanged.